The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
The threat from terrorism is real, but we will overcome it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And there's a certain irony in the way the president tried to reassure the nation on Sunday night, I think, reiterating what he has said in the past and also clinging to his own way of speaking about the group that has become the enemy that could define his presidency in the last months of his second term.
We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless.
Obama says ISIL, most everyone else says ISIS. It seemed to betray a certain stubbornness as President Obama tried to find clarity on ISIL, ISIS, or Daesh. Is this a new chapter? Or has the president missed something and finds himself playing catch-up?
The terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino.
Of course, Fort Hood was some time ago, and that would make this new phase not so new. What to do now? Not a lot. Airstrikes over Syria and Iraq couldn't have stopped the married couple in San Bernardino. Neither of them was on a watch list of any kind, which makes this statement puzzling.
There are several steps that Congress should take right away. To begin with, Congress should act to make sure no one on a no-fly list is able to buy a gun. What could possibly be the argument for allowing a terrorist suspect to buy a semi-automatic weapon?
It's hard to argue with that statement, but again, it relates more to the Paris attacks in November rather than the California attacks last week. As the president handed an issue to the Republicans, here's presidential candidate Marco Rubio.
People are scared not just because of these attacks, but because of a growing sense that we have a president that's completely overwhelmed by them. And this is a president that called them the JV when they first emerged, ISIS did. And then just on the eve of the Paris attacks, basically argued that they were being contained, called the attacks in Paris a setback, as opposed to a widespread terrorist attack that showed real progress on behalf of ISIS.
How much can the government do right now to defend against attacks like the one in California? And if it's not much, can the president's opponents say it's not enough without having to offer any alternatives? Scott Shane, national security reporter for The New York Times and author of the new book Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, says the choices for the president are narrowing.
The president felt and his aides felt that he had to go out and say something because of the palpable fear that a lot of people have related to the San Bernardino attack. And this sort of pattern goes all the way back to 2009 when President Obama did not come out right away after the so-called underwear bomber tried to blow up that plane over Detroit on Christmas Day. And they, you know, came to believe that that was a mistake and that if the president doesn't sort of get out in front of the public on an occasion like this, the vacuum is filled often by his Republican critics. So he certainly tried to, he ran through the things the government is doing and tried to give a sense both of what the government's trying to do to prevent, to defeat ISIS and to prevent attacks like this. But he spent almost as much time talking about what he thought the government should not do, including sending large numbers of ground troops invading Syria, invading another Muslim country. And, sort of discriminating against American Muslims, lumping all Muslims together with these this married couple in California, which he said would make the problem much worse.
Do airstrikes have an impact on this kind of an attack? Your colleague David Sanger is quoting sources saying that the number of airstrikes after 9/11 was far greater than the number of airstrikes that have been conducted in the last 16 months, and that that may have some sort of impact on this particular attack. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the idea that there's a relationship between airstrikes in Syria and Iraq on the one hand and the attack in California on the other hand, I think that's a real stretch. There's no evidence of a connection between ISIS, the Islamic State, in its sort of headquarters in Syria, on the one hand, and this this couple in California on the other hand. The only connection there is that the wife in this couple posted on Facebook about the time they began the attack that you know, she was swearing her allegiance to the head of the Islamic State. But it appears to be so far not a, a situation where ISIS, you know, sort of had command and control and told these guys what to do, when to attack, but rather a sort of long-distance radicalization where they were on the internet reading about the Islamic State, reading about ISIS, and taking matters into their own hands. So it's hard to connect airstrikes in Syria, or anything, in fact, in Syria with this attack. The other thing that complicates matters is that President Obama took a lot of heat for saying previously that he believed that ISIS was contained in Syria and Iraq. The fact is that in terms of seizing territory, everybody remembers that ISIS was sort of on a roll in 2014 grabbing territory. And in that sense, they have been contained and even driven out of a couple of cities. The problem is the relationship between that and terrorist attacks of this kind is not always what you might expect. Terrorism is a weapon of the weak. And if the United States and its allies pound the headquarters of ISIS and essentially drive them underground, take away this notion that they're building a successful state there, it's quite plausible that some of their supporters will react by lashing out with their own terrorist attacks in places like California. So it's not necessarily that if we take a tougher approach and are more militarily successful in Syria, that we'll be able to eliminate all these attacks, certainly in the short run.
Which suggests the White House is faced with two really undesirable options. One would be to concede territorial gains in Syria and Iraq for ISIS as a way of buying them off. Some have said that you know, this is what the Saudis have done all along with ISIS. And I'm wondering if we look at the biography of Tashfeen Malik, the spouse in this case, who you referred to a moment ago, and you and the LA Times have done incredible work in trying to figure out what went on with her. She was in the United States on a K-1 visa, a spouse visa, and had spent time with her father in Saudi Arabia, where members of her family had suggested that she had become, if not radicalized, profoundly different in her approach to Islam and her approach to the world. Is there any discussion among sources that you talk to that this was a very long time coming sort of radicalization, that she might have been looking for a situation like this and that it had been years in the making?
I mean, that's speculation at this point, but that's certainly a possibility. Her history, both in Pakistan at a university where there's a lot of radicalism in the area, and in Saudi Arabia, you know, are both sort of clues that federal investigators are looking at. I don't think they really have any answers. One of the things that makes this difficult is that most people who carry out these kinds of attacks, you find, have spent months or in some cases years on the internet, sort of immersed in the world of Islamic radicalism. And you don't necessarily need to be in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia to pick this stuff up. As we saw, for example, in 2013 with the Boston Marathon bombers, those brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, had you know, for the most part, been radicalized, it appears, online. So, you know, there's no necessity to track this back to Pakistan, to track it back to Saudi Arabia, because the internet puts this ideology and many of its proponents and supporters of ISIS, of the Islamic State, right there, you know, on your phone, on your laptop, for you to communicate with or you know, learn from every day.
Would you say that there's any sort of look at the K-1 visa process as a result of all this?
Well, the president last night actually misspoke and referred to the visa waiver program, said that this woman had come in on the visa waiver program.
Yeah, he's wrong.
Say. Yeah, as you say, that was an error, but perhaps it underscores that there are a lot of ways to come into this country, and that is part of what this country is, and it's hard to imagine that you can stop every person with ill intent from from coming into the United States. Let's face it, in this country, we kill 14, 15, 16,000 people in murders every year, of which, the 14 killed in San Bernardino are about a tenth of 1%. So, we don't need to necessarily focus on immigrants coming to this country or visitors coming to this country to understand who poses a threat to our safety.
Finally, then, on that precise point, Scott, did the president miss an opportunity to talk about radicalization more broadly because the Colorado Springs shootings took place just a week before the San Bernardino attacks, and that there are a variety of pathways to radicalization in the United States, as we well know?
Yeah, I think he made a couple of generic references to extremism, but in this case, he went a little farther than he has in the past and said that people in the Muslim community, while they should absolutely not be blamed for something a tiny number of Muslims do, they must confront, was his language, elements in the Muslim community who embrace radicalism, who embrace violence. But I think, probably the president felt that in this particular atmosphere, it was a bad time to refocus on the man who attacked a Planned Parenthood. And, it's interesting that experts who count these cases say that the number of deaths from attacks by radicalized Muslims, who sort of embrace jihadism, is just about the same since 9/11, has been just about the same since 9/11 as deaths from attacks by right-wingers, white supremacists, and anti-abortion protesters, and so on.
Scott Shane, national security reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He's author of the new book, Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
What we may be seeing in France right now is the radicalization of a nation. In the first round of regional elections, the National Front, France's far-right party led by Marine Le Pen, secured 28% of the votes, more than any other party. It's far short of a majority, but will put Le Pen in a position to influence national policy more than ever before. The vote signals a turning inward by France after the November 13th Paris attacks and a nationalist trend that hasn't been seen in France since the end of World War I. Alan Riding is a journalist and author. He joins me now from Paris. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, John.
Is this a victory, a milestone victory for Marine Le Pen, or is this a fleeting bit of electoral success that is likely to be reversed in the years to come?
It's certainly not fleeting because it's been a long time coming. Her father, in 13 years ago, managed to get to the second round of the presidential election. So the Le Pen shadow has been hanging over France for a long time. However, with his retirement and the takeover of Marine Le Pen, his daughter, things have changed a lot. And she has modified, she's moderated the party, she's stopped any suggestion of anti-Semitism, and she's focused much more on what she considers the failure of the political class to run France well. And in that case, she has a lot to work with. Now, you could say that some of this has been accelerated by the terror attacks a few weeks ago, by the wave of immigration into Europe in the last few months. However, the situation, the stage was, in a way, already set before those things happened. People, you know about populism in the United States in this Republican campaign. People are fed up with the failure of one party or the other of the two main parties to deliver. We've had years and years and years of 10% unemployment, which is not, again, a function of the world financial crisis. It's institutionalized. And people are looking for another solution, very simply.
In the process of politics in France, what does this first round mean in terms of actually assembling a government? How quickly will we begin to see Le Pen's influence in national policy?
Well, Marine Le Pen's influence in national policy is very much alive and well today, because her party can rightly claim to be the biggest party in France today. Now, her party has won in the first round six of the uh, of has the largest number of votes, shall we say, in 6 of 13 regions. We have in France a very complicated situation where you have a second round. And therefore, it's a question now whether the parties that have lost in the regions where she has, where her party has won, whether they're going to join forces to try and block her or go on their own and, in effect, allow the National Front to take over the region. But the bottom line of it is that the National Front is going to be running between 2 and 6 regions. That's almost half the regions of France. Now, the French system is very complicated because you have a central government, you have regions, which are like states, shall we say, you have departments, which are a bit like counties, then you have large cities, towns, communes, and everyone has a bit of the action. So running a region doesn't mean you dominate everything, because some of the power, a lot of the power remains in the central government. However, there are very crucial areas like education, and this is one area which could, where the National Front could have its influence, because it believes that education in France has been drifting away to a sort of vague multiculturalism and acceptance of all sorts of non-French values and non-French traditions. So they would certainly aim for a much more nationalistic education policy, and that could be very important and could be very controversial.
And there's a long-standing tradition of nationalist parties around the world focusing on education first, because it sows the seeds for the next generation of supporters. Is there a conceivable likelihood that in the second round, Marine Le Pen would come out even in a better position to create a coalition with her at the center? Or how does this work once a government is formed?
What we're having here are two things. One are regional battles where, in effect, Marine Le Pen has a very good chance of emerging on top and running a whole area of northern France as a regional leader. But this is really also viewed as a referendum on the socialist government of François Hollande, a referendum on the political class in general. And in that sense, it's a real earthquake. So everyone can, in a sense, live with these results. In some regions, they'll be very unhappy and people very worried that the socialists have done so badly across the country. But we knew the socialists were doing so badly. François Hollande has a popularity rate of barely 20%. So that wasn't a great surprise. The surprise is that under Marine Le Pen, the National Front has managed to organize itself as a national party. It's got a structure across the whole country. They are a real party. The question is, how is this going to be transferred in a year and a half in presidential elections?
So even though they're distinct in process terms, this really does mark the beginning of the national election campaign a year and a half from now. There's no talk of early elections. That doesn't work in France, right?
No. Unless the president were to resign, which he's not going to do. In fact, the president himself is still wanting to run for office. There are those in his party who would like him not to run for office because they believe there are other people within the socialist ranks, including the prime minister, Manuel Valls, who would do much better if President Hollande insists on being the socialist party candidate. Many people, as we stand today, if there was a three-way run in the first round, François Hollande would not make the second round.
Wow.
And the second round would be probably with lots of question marks, between Marine Le Pen and Nicolas Sarkozy, the former president.
Alan Riding is author of And the Show Went On, Cultural Life in Nazi-Occupied Paris. Thanks so much, Alan.
Thanks, Sean.
The UN Climate Change Conference continues in Paris with progress, the verdict at halftime. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
Today, as never before, the stars are aligned in favor of a strong, concerted action on climate change.
This is the second and final week of the conference. Coming up, a debate over our response to climate change. Can the nations of the world unite in Paris and save the day? Or is it time to accept that we will soon need to adapt to a radically changing environment? That's later this hour on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Squarespace, providing tools to create a professional website. Learn more at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
The second week of the Conference of the Parties, or the COP21 Climate Conference in Paris, has confirmed a worldwide consensus to confront global warming. But how is the challenge of this conference, and each nation will be able to put forth an approach as an agreement is hammered out in the next 5 days? Within the activist community, though, there is a deep division over how to approach global warming. Are we too late to stop catastrophic climate shifts in this century, or can the power of global consensus head off disaster? Anthony Lazarwitz is director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. He is still hopeful and believes that the cavalry in the form of political action can save the day. But Dugald Hine, director and co-founder of the Dark Mountain Project, says we need to prepare for a grim realignment on planet Earth.
For me, the sort of journey into awareness of climate change is probably pretty similar to the one that a lot of people go through, of a sense of the scale of the crisis, and you begin to change your life and your activity. You switch off every light that someone's left on. You find yourself at the end of a shift in the newsroom standing on tables to switch off all of the monitors. And then you hit another threshold where you realize that you could do all of those things and it probably still wouldn't be enough. But what was more troubling to me was the realization that people I was meeting who were prominent voices within the movement that I'd been becoming part of were standing up and giving the same speech that you'd heard them giving 5 years earlier. But if you caught the same person at the end of the night quietly over a drink, they would admit that actually they were in a place of pessimism verging on despair. So the beginning of the work that Paul and I came together to do around Dark Mountain was this realization that environmentalism was in danger of becoming a church where the priests had lost their faith, but they didn't think that the congregation were ready to hear the bad news yet. So this kind of gap between the motivational speeches and the personal pessimism of a lot of the leading voices within the movement that we were part of.
And Anthony, where did you start and where did you end up?
So I started back in 1990, where I worked at the Aspen Global Change Institute, literally working with the world's leading climate scientists. And it was intense. Certainly among the scientific community, it has been very clear about what the problem is, what the causes are, what the consequences are going to be for several decades. But at the same time, it was also very clear to me that we were not responding. And that became a key question in my mind, is why don't human beings respond to this? So I went back to school and ultimately got a doctorate, and then subsequently devoted my career to trying to understand that question. What is it about the way that we think? What is the way about the way that we feel? So kind of the psychological dimensions that lead us to be able to respond to some issues and not so well to others. And then using all of those kinds of insights, trying to figure out then how do we become much more effective at actually engaging people in a constructive way.
And how do we become more effective? What is the way to do that?
So I think, first of all, we have to recognize this is a systemic problem. And that means there's no single silver bullet. Bill McKibben has beautifully said there's no silver bullet. We need silver buckshot. We need action by governments. We need action by industry. We need action by citizens. All of these need to come into play because we're talking about fundamentally transitioning, and this really is at the heart of it, transitioning from a 19th century energy system, which is still based on digging stuff up out of the ground and setting it on fire, to the 21st century energy system, which we all know is happening. It's the renewable clean energy system, much more efficient, all the same services that we still want and desire today, and in fact, many people around the world fundamentally deserve, who are still in energy poverty. And there's only one way we're going to solve it, and that's by rolling up our sleeves and get going.
Dugald, what's wrong with that approach?
Well, I think that the danger is here that we end up talking about this as a problem which is going to be solved with technical, policy, economic answers. And if I look back, I've seen world leaders standing up making grand statements about the scale of the challenge that we're facing all of my life. And meanwhile, if I look at how many years has the global carbon emissions gone down in that time, it's happened once, and that was in 2009 after the global economic crisis. So you get this gap between this message of optimism and roll up our sleeves and let's do it, and a deeply ominous reality that is continuing to play out. And our whole way of living is being called into question at levels that go deeper than simply, you know, substituting solar for coal as where the juice that's coming out of the socket.
Anthony, do you think it's appropriate to adapt, to focus on the well-founded and solid track record of humans adapting down through history?
You know, I hear what Dougald is saying, and he's, in part, he's exactly right. But here's the analogy. I think in many ways this issue is like we've been driving in a car, it's late at night, it's foggy, and we're coming down a mountain pass. And long ago, we already chose this path. So we can't back up, we can't turn around. The kids are in the back, they're not buckled, we're fiddling with a radio, we're probably eating something at the same time, or we're distracted. Warning signs keep going by, basically telling us that we have windy, bumpy landslides up ahead and so forth. And right now, our foot is still on the accelerator and not on the brake. We're now committed to hitting a windy, bumpy, and dangerous part of the road. The question is, do we begin hitting the brake and making sure that we enter that stretch of road at, say, 10 or 15 miles per hour, at which point, you know, we may have an accident and there will be some damage, but we'll get through? Or do we hit that same patch of road at 80 miles an hour, in which case it's going to be devastating? And so I think you're actually beginning to see a lot of action across the world by companies, by countries, by citizens to demand that scale of change. But we will hit this patch of road. There is no doubt about that.
And if it means mass starvation and flooding, that's something that artists would have to deal with, right?
Sure, absolutely. There is, I look to the future with considerable foreboding.
Dougald Hine is the director and co-founder of the Dark Mountain Project, and Anthony Leiserwitz is the director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication.
Coverage of climate change on The Takeaway and WBEZ Chicago is part of a project called Heat of the Moment. There's more at wbez.org/heat. And support is provided in part by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. And Squarespace, a website builder that provides domains, hosting, and website templates, all with 24/7 customer support. More at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Deep behind the walls of prisons in America, mental illness festers in a furnace of anger and neglect. Only occasionally do inmates receive treatment, and only then it's after a long trail of crime, violence, and abuse. In this Vice News documentary, an inmate in the Cook County Jail in Chicago tries to explain his behavior during a group therapy session.
We feel comfortable being uncomfortable. In some form, I used to think I was trying to commit suicide in some way, or just on a small scale, or just buying some narcotics. It's a form of suicidal because I'm not knowing what I'm about to put in my body. It doesn't matter to me sometimes.
More than half of all inmates in U.S. prisons and jails suffer from some kind of mental illness. Day after day, judges see defendants who have committed crimes but who really need some form of treatment. And the only option is prison. Today, the healthcare system for millions of disturbed Americans is the prison system. That might have been where Dallas County District Attorney Susan Hawk ended up when severe depression nearly destroyed her life. But her support network and a healthcare system unavailable to the poor saved her. Suddenly, the mentally ill people she saw in court as a prosecutor and a judge were not so different from her. Susan Hawk has become a national leader for reform in the way we deal with mental illness in the criminal justice system.
One thing that I noticed as a judge prior to being elected DA was that about 30% of the people that were coming into my courtroom had been diagnosed with a mental illness. And we were traditionally putting them in minimal sentences in the penitentiary, and that simply just did not work. So I created a specialty court in addition to my regular docket that focused primarily on mental health issues and individuals that were mentally ill and then had co-occurring disorders with substance abuse.
Why do you think the criminal justice system has become this repository for so many people with mental illness, some of whom are actual criminals with mental illness, but others of whom are just people with mental illness who have no other place to go.
I just think flat out there's not the services that are necessary to treat them. Judges and other individuals in the criminal justice system, we didn't, you know, you knew they were a danger, but you knew they were sick, and you wanted to give them help. And just really, we've come a long way in Texas in the past 10 or 11 years on mental health resources. But it's unfortunate that it seems that you only get the help once you're in the system. There's a big gap for individuals that are not in the criminal justice system, but they just need help, and the resources are hard to come by.
Who's a success story in your experience, and who's fallen through the cracks? And without betraying any confidences or privacy issues, can you give me a sense of their face, who they are in these individual stories?
Mainly my experience on the bench was dealing with these through my specialty court program, which is a mental health diversion program. And these were the highest risk offenders in the criminal justice system. But they were either bipolar, schizophrenic, major depressive disorder. Most of them were on drugs. And these were the individuals that go to the penitentiary on a minimal sentence, be out in 6 months and back on the street. And so I saw time and time again individuals that instead of sending them into the penitentiary, which historically it happened, is placing them in a diversion program where they had a network or a support system in place as far as judicial monitoring, a caseworker, a probation officer, people that were there to support them. And we gave them that kind of that collaborative approach to their treatment. And I can't tell you how many times I saw an individual walk out of my courtroom reconnected with their families that they haven't seen in 20 years. Going to school, getting a job, you know, most of them just being stable on their medication was a huge success story. And so having that front seat to that every single, you know, day presiding on the bench is why I ran for district attorney, because I thought, why can't the DA's office have a DA-driven diversion unit that is preventing crime before it happens and providing the services that these folks deserve?
What does diversion mean?
Divert individuals away from the penitentiary and into services.
So the idea is to do basically a kind of triage at the front end of the criminal justice system, indicate that whatever happens sentencing-wise, these people are bound for something other than the penitentiary because of their mental health designation?
Yes, because 30% of the folks that are incarcerated are mentally ill, and by sending them to prison, we're not doing any good. It's just they're back out on the street within a matter of months in a much worse condition than they were before, and they're right back in the penitentiary. So we just have this revolving door. So the way we're doing it now is what we've set up something called the Reformative Justice Unit, is we're identifying these offenders once they come into jail. And if they're mentally ill, we tag them. And then we have programs in place to divert them into those programs, try to get them out of jail if they're not a harm to the, you know, safety issues are always a concern, and to put them into the services that they need through our diversion program. So we work really closely with them. And we work the public defender's office. And so it's just unique because it's from the DA side. You don't really hear about many prosecutors or district attorneys that are focusing on diversion. And I mean, there are some DA's office, of course, that are really cutting edge and doing these just as we are. Focusing on that in this one particular unit is what we're doing, you know, with young offenders and mentally ill offenders.
In your experience, can you give me a story of someone who's fallen through the cracks, either because the diversion program didn't work or just because it wasn't even tried in the days before you had your alternatives?
Yeah, I can just think of particular individuals that I had that were sentenced to the penitentiary and they came before me. And then they come back and they're back on the streets committing another crime. Then they go to the penitentiary again. And then they're looking up the next time they get arrested, you know, they're sick. And they're, you know, most of them are self-medicating, that they're looking at 25 to life in the penitentiary because they simply just did not get the services that they needed up front.
In Dallas, is Lou Sterrett the big prison in your county?
It's county jail.
It's a county jail. It's a county jail.
Yes.
And if I were to wander through the county jail, how would I hear the reality that it is the second largest mental health facility, as people at the jail like to say, in the state of Texas?
It might be the largest.
Yeah. Well, you compete with Harris County and Houston, I guess.
Yes. And I guess within our county, it's the largest mental health institution. But, I mean, we have a whole – there's floors that are dedicated to individuals that have been diagnosed with mental illness because there's such a need for it. Many of them are on suicide watch. We have a whole facility set up, and it's very impressive with the Sheriff Valdez with what she's done with it. And I think that we're one thing that the jail is, they're very progressive on treating these individuals. Of course, you can't catch everyone that comes through, but you can try your best. And I know that they're doing that and flagging these individuals automatically, and they're getting the medication that they need in jail as well. So a lot of times you might keep an individual in jail just to stabilize them on their medication and then place them into a program.
Have any of the people in your court system, knowing your story and knowing how public you've been about this, seem closer to you? Have they sort of suggested, thanks for speaking?
You know, I had someone come in a couple of days ago that had the same issues, and now he's out. He has a job. He's reconnected with his family, and he's now a pastor, and he's talking about these things. I can't tell you how many different stories I have like that, that in our community, people start talking about it. And I think once we start talking about it, people then realize it's nothing to be afraid of. It's just an area that needs help.
Susan Hawk, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Susan Hawk is Dallas County's district attorney. And here's something to take with you today. In the annals of resilience, there's no one to compare with former president, 91-year-old Jimmy Carter, who announced yesterday in his regular Sunday school class that his brain cancer is gone. Melanoma had spread to his brain, we learned last summer, but drugs and surgery turned things around. Not a miracle exactly, doctors say, but close. The Carter Center's motto is waging peace, fighting disease, building hope. They got that right. Give us your take at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on travel tips, Tabata training, toy making, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.